any preconceptions. Bereshit bara, or better probably, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim et haaretz. In the beginning of God creating the heavens and the earth, what was the earth like? Not nothing, but rather tohu vavohu. It was total chaos. And then what does God do? God goes about separating stuff, moving stuff around, so that what can happen? Vayivra Elohim et Adam b'tzalmo. God creates all kinds of life, culminating in the human. Okay, God makes order where before there was chaos. Now is where it gets a little loopy. Okay, in certain biblical texts, the forces of chaos are alive and well. By the way, in our daily life, the forces of chaos are alive and well. That's what the Bible is reflecting on, which I think is what makes it so real and so poignant. The forces of chaos are alive and well, and the primary image for that is that there is a primordial sea monster that God is struggling against. And if you ever studied Bible at an Israeli university, you may have heard something like the late, great Yecheskel Kaufman Bible saying, you know, the Bible has none of the mythology of the ancient Near East. This is incorrect, right? A variety of psalms have exactly this image of God slaying the sea monster. And in fact, one of the most poignant images, I have to say, in all of Tanakh is when Isaiah imagines that the slaying of the sea monster will happen in the future, because it clearly hasn't happened yet. Those of you, how many people went to a yeshiva day school in America? Oh my God, okay. So, you know, remember like your seventh grade teacher told you that like in the days to come, God was gonna slay the Leviathan and feed it to the Tzaddikim? That's this. That's the rabbinic version of this image. Okay, so now keep this in mind. God, in order to create the world, has to defeat the forces of cosmic chaos, often encapsulated, symbolized, I'm not sure what the right word is, by a sea monster. Okay? And then you see what I think is one of the most theologically provocative verses in all of Tanakh, Yecheskel Chavtet Gimel. If you want to go for a wild ride, find a chavrusa and start learning the book of Yecheskel. It is intense, okay? But Chavtet Gimel, Daber ve'amarta. Speak, Yecheskel, and say, Ko amar Hashem Elohim, this is what God has said, Hineni alecha paro melech Mitzrayim, I am about to deal with you, O Paro, king of Egypt. And then the amazing appellation that Yecheskel gives Paro, Hatanim hagadol, you great sea monster, you. Now this is so fundamental. Because I'm going to say it like this. Let's make believe we're taking the SATs for a minute. Pharaoh is to history what the sea monster is to nature. That is the force that stands on the side of chaos against life, trying to thwart God's plans. Paro is the sea monster. There is no greater way in biblical language of saying you are a force of evil. You are a force that exists to obstruct God's plans for life to flourish in the world. By the way, and he's described here, Harovetz Betochi Orav, who's flopping around in the Nile, Asher Amar, this is another beautiful pun, Liya Ori Va'ani Asitini, the Nile is mine, and I think the clear meaning here originally of Va'ani Asitini is, and I made it for myself, but Ani Asitini can also mean I made myself, the ultimate refusal of God. Ani Asitini, I created myself. Okay, so now, just kind of, this is the frame for a second. All of a sudden, the book of Exodus takes on a totally different life once Yecheskel has handed us this key. Okay, so now, look for a minute, and you'll start to see that the Exodus story makes a series of allusions to the creation story, or creation stories. Because, here I'm sort of giving away where I'm going, but I've already done that, right? Because the Exodus is not just about history, or certainly not just about the history of the Jews or the Israelites, it is also about another step in the cosmic battle against chaos. So what do I mean by this? Look, for example, source 4, Shmot Yudalit, Vayomer Hashem El Moshe, Matitz Akilai, why are you crying out to me? This is right, the Jews are on the verge of the sea. I'm saying Jews, pardon my anachronism, please, but Israelites, okay? Dabero b'nei Yisrael v'yisau, talk to the people and let them go. A strange thing to say, by the way, when they're standing on the verge of an ocean or a sea. But, okay? You should raise your staff. You should put your hand out and split the water. And then you see the same thing in number 5, which is not God's instructions, but actually Moshe is implementing the instructions. And then if you're paying attention, and you have Yechezkel in mind, you begin to notice, wait a minute, in Bereishit, God began by separating Yabasha and Yam, right? This is source 6, verse 10. Vayikra Elohim leYabasha Eretz, Mikvei HaMayim Kara Yamim, Vayar Elohim Kitov. Okay, so we have here the first clue that the book of Exodus may be alluding. Okay, if you're not convinced yet, that's fine. If you're not convinced yet, that's fine. I got more. Okay, so just bear with me. Okay, and then we have Makat Choshech, which is source 7, which you can read. But I just want to point out that what happens in Makat Choshech is God brings incredible, overwhelming darkness over all of Egypt, and then God adds, or the narrator adds, at the very end of this source, "Ulechol b'nei Yisrael haya or b'moshvotam," but for all of the Israelites, they had light in their dwellings. And what you hear now, I hope, is "Vayavdel Elohim bein haor levein hachoshech." God is dividing Egypt, just as God divided the world itself between light and darkness. All of Egypt is in darkness. All of Israel is in total light. The moments of Genesis are being recapitulated in the setup to the Exodus. This is actually, I think, incredibly important for understanding the theology of Tanakh as a whole. Now, if you are not convinced and you think that these are just coincidences, I invite you to look at verse 9, which is the single strangest pasuk in all of Chumash, in my opinion, unless this thesis holds. Okay? Vatar ha'isha vateled ben. The woman got pregnant and she gave birth to a son, Vatere oto kitov, which presumably means something like she saw that he was handsome, Vatitzpeneu shloshai rachim, and she hid him for 3 months. Of course, had he been ugly, she would have thrown him away, right? It's the strangest pasuk ever. Seriously, just think about this. Vatar vatele ben, by the way, let me read you the pasuk that would make sense. Vatar aisha vatele ben, Vatitzpeneu shloshai rachim. That is what a mother would do. Right? She got pregnant, she gave birth, and she hid the child from the murderers. But no, we hear instead, Vatar aisha vateled ben, vatere oto kitovu. Kitovu. She saw that he was attractive. Of course, what's going on here? Right? Is a direct allusion. It's sort of like, this is what I call the narrator hitting you in the head, saying, you haven't seen the other ones yet? How about this? Vayar Elohim Kitov. The birth of Moshe is a moment that matters in the cosmic unfolding of creation. It is not merely a moment in the history of Am Yisrael. It is also, and crucially, a moment in the drama of creation as a whole. Now, why does that matter exactly? Because this is not just about an ethnic god supporting one ethnic group against another. It's about the triumph of life over everything that stands in its way. That's what Paro symbolizes. Paro symbolizes, again, there's no better way, pan your bed, lest he multiply. I don't want there to be more of them. I don't want more life. And the God who says, can your bed, there will be more life. There has to be more life. Life is meant to flourish. And so, this is what God does here. Now, I'm going to skip source 10 for now. I might come back to it in a little while. We'll see how much time we have. I want to just now bring your attention to the fact that something really striking happens at the splitting of the sea, which is God physically recapitulates the action of creation. What does God do in the creation of the world? God takes water, pushes it up, pushes it down, and allows life to flourish right in the middle. What does God do with the sea? The same image is now turned on its side. God pushes water this way. God pushes water that way so that life can flourish in the middle. The splitting of the sea is the separation of the waters, is the declaration that this is a moment in the unfolding of creation. Right? Creation is now being reasserted in the face of the one who wanted to crush it. Creation is here victorious. And by the way, a discussion that I'm not going to have now that maybe we can do, maybe we can if we want to later, when I invite people to respond to some of this. This is not a nonviolent picture, to say the least. Meaning, in Exodus's view, there are times when at least God, I want to underscore that because I think it complicates the picture quite a bit. In Exodus, at least, there are moments when God needs to combat evil with force. What is also striking, which is kind of cutting out the legs of what I just said, is how much it seems that for the book of Exodus, it is God and God alone who does that. I remember once being in a class and someone said, the book of Exodus, the Yitzhak Mitzrayim is totally militaristic, right? To which I have to say my response is yes, except that there is no military and no weapons. Right? It's violent, but let's not confuse the terms. It's not militaristic. If anything, the book of Exodus goes, your Haggadah goes out of its way to make it seem like we didn't do anything. That's not necessarily glorifying God only. It's also taking the sting out of a potential militaristic reading of a text like this. It's not about an army. It's about God's force. Okay, there's more to say about that later if we get there. Now, there's also something that the song says. Source 11 talks about, I gave you a lot of it because I wanted to give you some context in case it wasn't totally fresh in your mind. But if you look at verse 16, Tipol aleihem imata vafachad, fear and terror fell upon the nations who heard what happened. Bigdol zoroacha yigmu ka'aven. And forgive me, but for those of you who like Hebrew, this is a biblical Hebrew, because of the way roots work, loves puns. It can never get enough of puns. Bigdol zoroacha yigmu ka'aven. So the word yigmu comes both from dalet mem hei, dama, they were like stone, and dalet mem mem, they were silent like stone. Two roots, both with meanings that are totally relevant to what's happening here, but this is not my main point. Ad ya'avor amcha Adonai, until your people crossed, O God, ad ya'avor amzu kanita, until this nation whom you kanita. Kanita, if you are a modern Israeli, you think kana means to buy. If you are a rabbinic Jew, you think kana means to acquire. If you are an ancient Hebrew speaker, which I'm sure many of you are, remind me to tell you a great story about that at the end. If you are an ancient Hebrew speaker, you know that the first and primary meaning of Kuf Nun He is to create. God is Kone Shamayim Va'aretz. This people you created is a really interesting thing to say at this moment, as opposed to this people you redeemed, this people you liberated, these people you created, meaning you just recapitulated the creation of the world for these people and made them yours in that action. Ad yavor amzu kanita, what Yeshayahu calls amzu yatzartili, this people I created for myself. Okay? Now, the main point I'm trying to make here is that for Shmot, in this first part, is that for Shmot, the stakes of the Exodus could not possibly be higher. On the one hand, they're high enough. It's God's chosen people being liberated from slavery when they finally cry out and God defeats their enemies and the empire is brought to its knees. Right? And yet, that's just not enough from Exodus' perspective. As big as that is, as crucial as that is, as powerful as that is, all of that, you know, is right. And yet also, this is a moment in the ongoing divine struggle to affirm life as against the forces of death, chaos, and their partner, brutality and callousness, which is what paro represents, right? Both of those things, brutality, callousness, bloodshed, all of it. I mean, if you read the first chapter of Shmuel, you see this is a guy with a vivid imagination for ways to harm people. And by the way, it's interesting, the Bible scholar Terry Fredheim, a really great Bible scholar who died like a year ago, Fredheim actually sort of argues that paro is in certain ways a biblical Hitler, in the sense that there's this constant struggle. On the one hand, he wants to kill them all, but he also wants their labor. And so he's doing stuff that's like undermines the fact that he wants their labor because he's also tempted to kill them, which probably sounds familiar if you've had like an elementary introduction to like what the Germans did to the Jews, right? He really is an embodiment of everything that that the Torah assumes God is not, right? Okay, before I go on, let me take questions, not yet rejoinders, questions. In America, I now say in public lectures, I would like to remind you that a question is not a speech followed by "Would you not agree?" But I don't want to, you know, cast aspersions on Israelis. So, are there any native Israelis in this room? Kimat. Avital. Again. Okay. Anyway, questions. Questions about what I've just said. Clarifications. Confusions. Hesitations. I'm expanding as I go. The silence is fascinating to me. Okay. Yeah, please.
You said in the beginning we have two operating planes, right? So what I wrote down is a paternalistic story about the Jewish people and kind of about the struggle of creation. If you would put it into two words, paternalistic versus universalistic, or...
No, because I don't think universalism is the main point here. I think it's, I would call it kind of, if I actually was going to use a pair of terms, I would do national versus cosmic or historic versus cosmic. And I also would then take back the verses and instead say and.
Right?
It's not historic or cosmic. It's historic and cosmic. That's the point. The historic is a moment in the greater cosmic. Okay, does that make some sense? Okay. Anybody else? Yeah, please.
With the question of what was the divine timing of the story of the Pesach, the redemption from Egypt, the timing, why 210 years, would that be tantamount to be asking what was the timing of creation? Like, what was that timing?
I don't think so. I mean, I'll give you what I think is like a not that interesting an answer. I think that for whoever is responsible for the Book of Shmot, how's that for dancing around the verse crowd? That for whoever was responsible for the Book of Shmot, it is enormously important that the people cry out before God redeems them.
Right.
That, I think that point is largely sort of historical, psychological, more than cosmic. I don't have a cosmic reading of that point. I think that point is actually mainly about the people, which is, this is a really interesting claim. You find this actually played out in modern times in the Sfas Emes of all places, but this idea that somehow God will not redeem the one who has not decided already that his current fate is intolerable. And you can go to school with a lot of psychotherapy just on that claim, right? If you're not dissatisfied on some level with the status quo, there's no redemption that's possible. There has to be a kind of grating against it. People often ask, I mean, legitimately, well, what has God been doing all this time? Like, what, you know, why did this take so long? But I really do suspect that for Exodus, God is waiting for a cry. Just is what I mean. I think that's actually what's going on. Yeah, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I was going to ask another question.
Okay.
So I definitely am seeing the parallels between the beginning of Bereshit and the beginning of Shemot. What I'm finding harder to see is a cosmic narrative in Shemot, unless you're getting at something else I'm not quite getting. Like I see the parallels between the stories, but to me Shemot still really feels like a national story. But that parallels.
Yes. So it here's the thing. Here's the skillfulness that the narrator needs to have. He does not want to efface the national story, nor does he want to turn it into a mere symbol. He wants to say, and it's also greater in its reverberations and implications. And once you say, I see the parallels, you're already kind of, I think, making that point yourself, which is the very parallels are a suggestion that something greater than what's going on here is going on here. That was not an English sentence, but you know, something greater than what appears to be going on here is going on here as well. The parallel is everything. And again, I think, first of all, it's very hard for most Jews to have, understandably, another frame of reference about Exodus other than, well, the Exodus, right? And that's good, because again, I don't think the goal is to turn it into a symbol. It's real in the eyes of this book. And it's also something else. It's not just a moment in the history of the Jews, in other words, it's a moment in the history of the cosmos. When the history of this cosmic struggle of good against evil will be written, says the narrator of the book of Exodus, this is a moment that will matter. By the way, that is real audacity. This is, I mean, you could even say that's craziness, right? I mean, think about what Judaism is in a way. You take this little obscure ancient Near Eastern tribe that no one's ever heard of, they have this redemptive experience, and then they say, yeah, this is the most important story there is about the entire cosmos. I mean, it's not modest exactly. Right? No, really, it's claiming that something more is at stake. Okay? Yeah. Let's say someone who hasn't spoken yet, or then we'll go on. Alright, so hold it for can you hold it for a little while? Okay, great. Now, what I want to suggest then happens, and this is like, I don't think a tremendous chidush in and of itself, a tremendous innovation in and of itself, but I want to sort of show you how I think this plays out more in more places than is obvious, is that, so how do we understand the journey from Exodus to Sinai? And it seems to me, the more I have worked on and thought about the book of Exodus over the years, the more it seems clear to me that the project of the revelation at Sinai is to create a blueprint for a radical alternative to Egypt. To create the blueprint of what I would call an anti-Egypt. If Egypt is the place where the weak and the vulnerable can be stomped on, Sinai is a revelation of a radically different vision, an alternative vision for the world and for the possibility of what a society can look like. And the Israelites are essentially covenanted, charged with creating this society that is radically other. Okay? And we can see a couple of examples of this. Okay? So, look at source 12. I want to just look at these few verses because they're really, really interesting as a unit. And a lot of biblical ethics, I think, get played out here. V'ger lo toneh v'lo tilchatzenu. You shall not oppress or mistreat a ger. A ger, someone who is not part of the kin group, but who has come to live among you. Because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, one of the great commentaries on Rashi's commentary. That's how Jews are. Points out, he says, you know, don't make the mistake of thinking that the prohibition on oppressing Egyptians derives from the experience of slavery in Egypt. That would be insane. That would be like saying, Paro could say, Ani lo hayiti ger be'eretz Mitzrayim, az li mutar. Right? I was not a stranger in Egypt, so I can do whatever I want. No, there's a basic moral obligation not to oppress the downtrodden. But you have reason for a more profound sympathy, empathy, some understanding. V'atem yedatem, Exodus 23:9 will say, v'atem yedatem et nefesh hager, which I think can be translated almost accurately as you know the life experience of the stranger.
What is that?
Exodus 23:9. That's a repeat of the prohibition, and the explanation is atem yedatem et nefesh hager. You know what it feels like. Okay? So you have an extra sensitivity, or you must have an extra sensitivity. And then, so that's first. First of all, the ger. Why is this important? Because the Israelites were gerim in Eretz Mitzrayim, and Mitzrayim was a place that xenophobically attacked them and reduced them to slavery and tried to genocide all of its males. Or at least all of its male children. You must represent an alternative to that, where the ger is embraced, and that is, of course, radicalized in Vayikra and Devarim, where the mitzvah becomes not just to not oppress the stranger, but to actively love the stranger. Ve'avtem lo kamocha ki geri mitzvah beretz Mitzrayim. Okay? And then we hear, kol olmanavi atom lo ta'anun. Any widow and orphan, you shall not oppress. Both of those categories, by the way, just to situate us in biblical law, are, this is only understandable in a patriarchal society. Both of those are categories of people who have lost the male who is economically responsible for them. Okay? Omana. In fact, some feminist historians have argued that the Bible does not use the term omana for a wealthy widow, because a wealthy widow is not in the same predicament. We can talk about that later if people are interested in that, okay? Kol omana v'yatom lo ta'anun. You shall not oppress any widow or orphan. And now you should be hearing the beginning of the book of Exodus repeating itself in the law given to the Israelites. Im ane ta'aneoto, if oppress, you oppress them. This is the emphatic. Ki im ta'oki ta'akelai, shamoa eshma tzakato. If cry, he cries out to me, here will I hear his cry. Now, here's the thing about this verse. Inui, tzaka, and eshma, and lishmoa, are all fundamental words in God's decision to enter into Egypt to save the Jews. That is to say, just as I did not tolerate oppression when it was visited upon Israel, so I will not tolerate oppression when it is visited by Israel. And if you say, wait, but this is oppression of Israelites by Israelites, what about oppression of non-Israelites by Israelites? I will say, and we can talk about this later too if people would like, the story of Hagar has already dealt with that. Where you have Inui, Avdut, and Geirut in how two founding Israelites treat a Egyptian with the name Hagar, the stranger. Okay? Now, what will I do? Here it gets very threatening. I will get very angry and I will kill you with the sword. Here, your wives will be widows and your sons will be orphans. This, I want to state the total obvious here. Shmot, the ideal in Sefer Shmot is not that you will not oppress people because you're scared to death that God will smite you if you do. This is what's called a backup plan. That is to say, this is actually very important. One of the things that I've argued in my own writing, and I'm still working on a version of saying this better, virtue is extraordinarily important in Judaism. It is so important that it is the second most important thing. The first thing is the plight of the defenseless. So I would like you to not oppress people because atem yidatem et nefesh hager. But im atem lo muchanim for that reason not to oppress them, fine, I'll kill you. Because the most important thing is, you better not oppress them. Okay? And then comes the law about not dunning. Dunning is a word I think used only by Bible translators, pressuring someone to repay a loan. Okay? You may not dun your fellow, the poor person. And then what I just wanted you to note is this is ostensibly a law code. Law codes do not usually stop to make emotional pleas. Right? And yet, look what it says here. Which basically destroys the whole idea of collateral. If you take something in collateral, you have to give it back each night. In other words, it's not collateral, because your need for collateral is trumped by their need for clothing. Yours is an economic need, theirs is a basic elemental human need. That comes first. Ki hu sutola vado, right? This is his only clothing. Husim latola oro. This is the shirt for his skin. Bamei yishkav. What else is he going to sleep in? This is not how law codes tend to speak. This is what I would call a case of God can't help God's self. Right? I mean this quite literally, meaning like, I'm telling you, this can't be. Basic moral imagination here. Imagine yourself in that predicament and ask yourself if it's okay. In other words, by the way, the standard laws of how economies function are suspended in the face of the reality of human need. We are in a Shemitah year in Eretz Yisrael. Deuteronomy 15 is about, we're going to talk about that more in depth in a minute, but Deuteronomy 15, in Deuteronomy, Shemitah is not about land. Shemitah is about what? Debt. It is about overturning the way economies work so that there can be no entrenched poverty. I don't think that's a particularly ideological reading on my part. I think that's actually what's going on in the text. Okay, now. So then you have source 13, which is where Inui, Ze'aka as opposed to Tzaka, but Zion and Sadi are basically interchangeable. And Shamoa Eshma. And then we get to source 14, the Shemitah, which I just started mentioning. And there's a lot I could say here, and I actually am going to skip the text that I brought here, and instead talk about the part that I should have brought but didn't, which is what happens next. So what happens next is that God says, you must release the slave after 6 years, a debt slave. By the way, it's very difficult to figure out what is going on in that text in the pshat. Is it, as the text seems to say, that when you have a debt slave, they serve you for 6 years and then you have to release them? Or is it that in the Shemitah year, the slave is released meaning he could have been a slave for 3 months, or he could have been a slave for 5 years, it's Shemitah, you let him go. Most people read this and say, well, the words seem clear. The words seem to say that an eved that you have, a slave that you have, serves you 6 years and then goes free. Except the logic of the chapter is that in the seventh year, all debts are canceled. The only slavery that's permitted is debt slavery, which would seem to mean that you could have become my debt slave 2 weeks ago and I have to let you go now because there are no more debts. But here's actually the main point I want to make about this. In contrast to Shemot, which seems to indicate that at the end of 6 years, you just let him go. Deuteronomy 15 says, you don't just let him go, you give him enough of your stuff to give him a fresh start. Why, by the way? Because if you free a debt slave and give him nothing, he'll be in debt again by dinner time. Right? Because he doesn't have any food or anything that belongs to him. But here's the thing. It then says, you should remember that you were slaves in the land of Egypt, which on the one hand you can say, okay, so that's about empathy. Yes, it is about empathy, but it's also about something else. You were slaves, and I liberated you, and I didn't just do what Shemot said. I fed you until you were able to stand on your feet. I gave you of my stuff. No, better. I gave you of their stuff, which all of a sudden explains why B'nai Israel are invited to quote-unquote borrow stuff from the Egyptians, because they owed them a start. After all, they were slaves, and the slave owner has to give a new start to the redeemed slave. Hence, it's not stealing, it's getting what you deserve as your payment for the beginning of a new life. God is here saying, I want you to learn from me as a model of what it means to liberate a slave. I never for one second contemplated I was going to take you out of Egypt and say, good luck. Right? I didn't do that. So you can't do that either. By the way, it is incredibly interesting to read the laws of slavery in Dvarim as a partial critique of the laws of slavery in Shemot. First of all, that, what I just said, about giving them a fresh start, but then also, Dvarim's non sequitur, V'chein la'amatcha ta'asekein, which, if you read Shmot, it isn't clear that female slaves are liberated at all. You read Devarim, and Devarim says, oh yes, and female slaves too. And that, by the way, is part of a different lecture to give about the ways that Devarim is in many ways consciously developing a whole series of biblical laws in a proto-feminist direction. This was a famous argument by the late Moshe Weinfeld at the Hebrew University. Here's a great example of this in case it sounds crazy. This is really subtle. The law of not coveting in Shmot, Lo tachmod beit re'echa, and then included in beit re'echa is the wife. You get to Devarim's version of the Ten Commandments. What is it? Lo tachmod eshet re'echa v'lo titaveh, and then don't covet your neighbor's wife, and also not his house and all the stuff in it. What is Devarim saying to Shmot? A woman is not part of the house. She's not a piece of property. She's separate. It's really striking, actually, when you read them together. Okay. And here comes the pièce de résistance, if you will, of the book of Devarim about how to create an alternative to Egypt. Here's context. All over the ancient Near East, it was forbidden to harbor fugitive slaves. The only reason it was ever permitted to allow a runaway slave to stay in your house was if you had captured him to return him to his master. And all over the ancient Near East, the punishments were grave, both for the slave and the one who tried to harbor him, including, in some cultures, death. Okay? This is the culture in which Deuteronomy is operating. Now comes Deuteronomy, chapter 23, verse 16. This is text 16. Lo taskir eved el Adonav. You may not return a fugitive slave to his master. Asher yinatzel elecha, who comes to you seeking refuge, me'im Adonav. And the word yinatzel there is really important. Yinatzel, right, from the hitzalti, same word, saving, okay? And then here, I'm going to read this in an over-the-top way for a minute, because I want you to hear something here. Imcha yeshev, bekirbecha, v'makom asher yivchar, ve'echad sharecha, batovlo. Five different versions of, you know where the runaway slave lives? Not in a shelter, but wherever he wants. If a runaway slave in ancient Israel shows up and says, I'll take your living room, it belongs to him. Wherever he, quote-unquote, damn well pleases, which is how I would translate Betovlo. I think that that's actually the pshat of what Betovlo means, especially when it comes on the heels of four other things. Now, Lotonenu, which is amazing. Don't let him come into the land only to take advantage of him. That would be the ultimate despicableness. Right? Here's something that is kind of fascinating. Deuteronomy uses the phrase "Lamakom Asher Yivchar" 18 times. 17 times it refers to God's choice to dwell in Yerushalayim. The 18th time it refers to the slave's freedom to dwell wherever he chooses. Which is why my essay on this in the Heart of Torah is subtitled "Why Runaway Slaves Are Like God." That is to say, they have absolute freedom to live wherever they want, and you must grant it to them. You are a nation of runaway slaves. I did not give you back to your master. Actually, I killed your master. Or I killed your master's armies. Whatever you want to say there. You are a nation of runaway slaves. How on earth could you imagine that you're going to return a runaway slave to his master? You learn nothing from your experience? I harbored you. Use the image of the Bible, under my very wings, I harbored you. By the way, this is to me the most important question you can ask about these texts. Don't domesticate them by admiring them, but ask, what claim do these texts make on us in the present tense? I do not think, I want to be clear about this, despite protestations of people on all sides of the political spectrum, you cannot learn one-to-one correspondences between biblical verses and contemporary policies. But you certainly can learn thrusts and directions. What is the responsibility of Jews when many social scientists claim more people are enslaved in the world today than ever before in human history? Probably know, as you go to shul, you hear this lamed, and then you say, oh, you're a great laner, what's for kiddush? But God just threw a stick of dynamite at you. You may not return a slave to his master. Because that's who you are. That's what we're trying to build here. Right? So now think about all these cases put together. Egypt was a place where the Gerim were abused. Don't abuse the stranger, love the stranger. Egypt was a place where the vulnerable were made to cry out in their suffering. Just know that I'm still listening. I'm the same God with your oppression, whether you're the oppressor or the oppressed. Protect runaway slaves. After all, you are that. When you liberate a slave, remember how I liberated you. Give them a fair start. These are the seeds of a different kind of society. That's the aspiration. Now, can I ask someone to just fill this with water? Do you mind? Thank you so much. Questions about this before I do a very quick part three and then take more questions. Yes, please.
Do you think there's a parallel, if we're looking for the parallels to the gracious, where God clothes Adam and Eve right before he basically kicks them out of Eden? Meaning, is it a continuum of godly behavior that you're seeing in the Exodus?
I think that that's a really interesting question, actually. I have often wondered when Chazal, when the sages take that God clothing Adam and Chava as the model for Mahu, Mabish Arumim Afata, just as God clothes the naked, so should you. Whether one of the things we're supposed to take from there is, just as God clothes the naked even when God is angry at them, which is a whole different level of intensity. I do think that there is some, I don't know exactly if it grafts onto the Exodus story, but there is something there about God's compassion even in the face of God's disappointment, which, as probably most people in this room, except for the, you know, total tzaddikim, know, is hard. I know I'm not really answering your question. I'm not sure how to answer your question, but I do think that there is something about the character of God there that is really important to the storyteller. That's the best I can do without really knowing how to answer. Yes, sir. Me too.
I wanted to ask if you could expound a little bit more on a point that you made where you said that there was not sort of one-to-one correspondences between Torah and political stances, but you can learn thrusts. And as a student of yours for a while, I feel like I've seen you make really powerful stances in particular ways, as I have other religious leaders based on particular themes. So I'd love to hear you sort of build on that point.
Here's what I mean by that, okay? The Torah is very clear, I think, about not oppressing and loving immigrants. That's what the Ger passages are about. The Torah can't tell me whether the United States should take in 7,000, 9,000, or 100,000 Syrian refugees this year. It cannot tell Israel exactly how many Ukrainians to take in. But what it can tell you is, let's start with this. Demonization and dehumanization of refugees is an abomination to God. That I think is a pshat reading of the laws of the Ger. That in itself is already covers a lot of ground in contemporary political debate. Right? In other words, again, where I think it gets to be a mistake is in saying, well, you know, you have to raise the number from this to this, because after all, can you read me 10 to Eretz Yisrael? Right? Yeah, okay, I mean, but it doesn't really work so easily. It's also hard to know how to move from an ancient agrarian economy to a global capitalist one. And some might want to say, okay, well, it means to dismantle the global capitalist. I don't know what it means. I know that there are certain, I know that the laws of economics are not the ultimate arbiter of what's right. You know why? Because the Torah tells me that over and over and over again. Right? So I'm not walking back any of the things you've heard me say. But I hope you've never heard me say, oh, I now know exactly which clause of which policy you should vote yes on because I just read Shmo. You understand what I'm saying? But I think that there's a lot of ground covered by saying the ethos is love and welcome immigrants. In a world overrun by xenophobia, that ain't nothing at all. So, yeah, I mean, I just think, and by the way, that's done on that temptation you see on all sides of the political spectrum, right? I read the Bible, and now I know I have to vote exactly on this thing. Think about the sheer madness of religious Zionism in the last moment. You know, I know what God thinks about this tiny piece of parcel of land. This is just a bizarre claim. I will be assassinated later. Yeah, please. I'm not important enough to be assassinated, but maybe just killed. Yeah.
On a different note, so you drew parallels between the beginning of Bereishit and the beginning of Shemot. And I'm wondering, as we were going through the laws in Shemot in the second section and from Devarim, mm-hmm. whether there's a correspondence between the end of Bereishit with Yosef's policies in Mitzrayim and the laws that we are then given in Shemot and Devarim.
This is shanui b'machloket among Bible scholars and has been for a long time. This is very much debated. What is Genesis's perspective on Joseph's economic policies? I tried to argue in the Heart of Torah with those who think that the Torah is actually fairly condemnatory of the fact that on the one hand Yosef is a hero and that he saves a tremendous number of lives, but he does it by essentially stripping the Egyptians down in such a way that he sets the economy in motion that will eventually consume his own family. Probably not.
Joseph sets in motion the economy that will
Joseph sets in motion the kind of economic stripping of the Egyptians that will eventually consume his own family. That is to say, he is responsible for this kind of enslaving of the populace. And I suspect that the Torah's perspective is, on the one hand, Joseph is a kind of administrative genius. On the other hand, there might have been a better way of doing this than making everyone, than building up the power of the empire to almost boundless limits. Is that English? Beyond any bounds or limits is what I'm trying to say. Am I completely convinced by my reading of that story? I'll tell you what bothers me about my reading of that story. Usually, in a story like that, you would expect to find more literary cues that are explicit, and I don't think you really find them there. However, I think the pathos of the story, like when the Egyptians say, "We have nothing but our corpses anymore," it's hard for me not to read that as, on some level, the narrator is putting in their mouths a critique of Yosef. Nothing but our corpses? We make corpses. They're not even dead yet. But like, you've destroyed us. You've made us, right? So I do think that's right. And the Israelites are certainly not permitted to build the kind of society that Yosef turned Egypt into. That, I think, is clearly right. Yes, please.
Just an additional. It's the beginning of Shema, it says, "V'lo yada es Yosef." It's specifically, Pare did not. There is a reference to Yosef there. I don't know how you want to read that in. But.
What do you think? Tell me what you think that work, that, what is that doing for you?
It seems that Pare is disconnecting the system that Yosef developed from the person. In other words, Yosef was big tzaddik, he's sort of, I don't know.
I don't think, Yosef had tzaddik, or Yosef had tzaddik, however we want to say it. I have a lot of different backgrounds, as some of you know. Grammarian parents and yeshivish educators. It's a very confusing mix, which is why I can barely speak English or Hebrew. Yosef HaTzadik is a totally Chazal thing. Meaning, and I suspect, although I'm not convinced that I'm right about this, it has to do with one specific thing, which is that he doesn't give in to the temptation to have sex with Eshet Potifar, which for Chazal is when you show your ability to be an agent, is when you exercise freedom in the face of sexual temptation. I suspect, I'm saying to you right now, I cannot prove this, and I have not researched this as well as I should, sort of like on the list, I suspect that that's why Yosef is called Yosef HaTzadik. It has nothing to do with anything here. Because it fits into, in other words, the Chazal's conception of Tzidkut. Okay. Yeah, one more, please.
I was just wondering how this can play out when you compare the way that the Torah or Halacha treats Jewish gerers versus ger toshavs or Eved Ivri versus Eved Nochri. Like, those same applications don't really, pan out.
Why are you asking me a hard question? Okay, no. All right. So first of all, let me just say actually here that it's really interesting because this is in some ways the softest part of your question. So occasionally, when I've taught texts on Geirut, somebody will get up and say, someone usually from a fairly frum background will say, "You're falsifying the text. Geirim are converts." That's a very strange argument. Because it's obvious that the pshat is not converts, unless you want to say that the Israelites, Geirim Hayitim Beretz Mitzrayim, you converted to Egyptian religion in Egypt. That's preposterous, right? The interesting question is, what happens to the pshat of a biblical text when Chazal undo the pshat? Right? What is the halachic status of a biblical text when Chazal undo it? By the way, I suspect the reason why that happens is the Israelites no longer had a political commonwealth, and so the texts on Geirut were threatening to fall into total disuse and meaninglessness. So a religious culture then figured out what its closest analog was to someone who's seeking refuge, and that became ger as convert. What made that possible is that Geirim already biblically were included in some ancient Israelite rituals. Okay? Now, why am I saying all this? Because we know, actually, this is something that Tzvi Zohar from Bar Ilan University has argued, I think, incredibly compellingly, that even when Chazal changed the meaning of a verse, the pshat still retains halachic status. Here's a great example of this. In almost all halachic texts, lifnei iver lo titein mikshol, not to place the stumbling block before the blind, are interpreted metaphorically. Don't give bad advice. Don't tell people things that are actually for your advantage, but lead them to think it's for their advantage. And yet, a variety of codes then say, also, you can't place a stumbling block before a blind person. Right? Which is interesting, because what they're saying seems to be that even when the pshat journeys away from the pshat in Chazal, the pshat still retains halachic status. It is an iser de oraita to oppress immigrants by the logic of that. Now, the distinction between Jews and non-Jews is quite difficult. In certain cases, the reason is economic. So, for example, you can't charge interest on a loan to an Israelite, but you can charge interest on a loan to a non-Israelite. What the Bible scholar Jeffrey Teagay points out, I think quite helpfully, is almost all non-Jews who are taking loans from Jews in ancient Israel are business people taking loans to start businesses. The Bible's primary concern with Jews taking out loans is poor people who are in debt. So it's actually, there simply aren't, right? Because the ger, am I making sense to you? I can't tell because you're wearing a mask and so I can barely see. But, right? In other words, so in some cases, at least, there are economic explanations for the disparities. In other cases, however, I do not have a solution for you. And one of the most interesting arguments that Rabbi Yitz Greenberg has made in his writing, which is really kind of as progressive gets in certain ways, is if Bnei Israel are given a blueprint according to which they're supposed to redeem the world, and they realize that the blueprint itself contains problems, they should also be allowed to redeem the blueprint. That's Yitz Greenberg as liberal, right? I mean, religiously liberal, right? That the halakha, if the halakha is meant to redeem the world, or to be a means for redemption, and, it fundamentally runs the risk of eternalizing patriarchy and leaving women voiceless. So, there is reason, based on the larger thrust of Sinai, to quote unquote repair or reinterpret the blueprint. I don't want to advocate that view right now, I just want to sort of lay it out there as one way that a contemporary Jewish thinker tries to deal with the issues you're raising. So again, it's three levels. One is that the pshat does remain when it comes to certain cases. Second, that that there are some instances where what appears like discrimination is actually a function of economic distinctions. And then there's the ones that I think you're probably really troubled by, which is like just seems unfair. I will tell you that I think it's Rav Shimon Shkap, one of the great Achronim, who, am I right about this? Yes, I think it's Rav Shimon Shkap, if I remember this correctly, who has this incredibly interesting argument where he says, you know, there are moral obligations that are universal, and what the covenant does is give you more intense obligations towards your family. But there are certain moral background that always applies. In other words, it can't be, I mean, we might struggle with this, right? But it can't be that the Torah is saying you can behave wantonly with a non-Jew. What it might say is you owe something to everyone and you owe something special extra to your family. That's his whole kind of reading of how law works. That has to do with law as... Let me stop there. I don't want to get totally lost in this. I hope that's at least a little helpful, something to chew on. Okay, I'm going to do the third part in like 2 minutes, okay? No, because I just want to sort of show you something interesting here, which is, why is it that in these packets... First of all, why do Israelis use paper that is too long? Can someone tell me this? Did my grandparents come here to drain the swamps to have paper that is too long? What is it with you people?
It's metric paper as opposed to U.S. paper.
Yeah.
It's U.S. paper.
Do you guys not know anything? Do you guys not know that the U.S. is the center of the universe? As we fall apart, so follows the world. Okay, so now, you may notice that the book of Exodus begins and ends with the Israelites engaged in a massive project of labor. And the transformation from beginning to end is that in the first instance, they are doing forced labor for a despot. And in the end, they are doing heart-driven labor for a God who insists on their dignity. And I will show you that the Bible is making that claim as quickly as I can, okay? So here's this amazing thing that my friend and teacher, Professor Ellen Davis from Duke University, was the first person I've ever seen point this out. I think this is just kind of incredible. When Moshe and Aaron go to Paro and say, we want a vacation, we want a religious vacation, right? Paro gets very angry, as you know, and says, this is totally appalling. How can you even ask that? And then he says, look at verse 5. I'm on source 17. Vayomer Paro, hein rabin ata am haaretz, vehishbatem otam misiv lotam. And you have asked for a Sabbath for them from their labors. Hishbatem. Here's the amazing thing. You know who introduces the notion of Shabbos into Sefer Shmot? Paro, in saying, to hell with you, I'll never give you a Shabbos.
Is this the first mention of Shabbat?
Yes, this is the first mention of Shabbat in the book of Shmot. V'hishbatem otam, which JPS translates as, you would have them cease from their labors. What are they supposed to do as translators? You would have them Sabbath from their labors. Right? Now why is this important? Paro says, I will never give you a Shabbat. And what does Moshe say when he gives the instructions to the building of the Mishkan to Bnei Israel? The very first thing he says is, Sheshet yamin teyasem lachav, v'yom ha-shvi yelachem kodesh, Shabbat Shabbaton l'Hashem. There will be no labor. I insist on the dignity of rest. I am the anti-Paro. Paro is enraged by the idea of Shabbat. I mandate the idea of Shabbat. And then, Bnei Israel, who were told to build in Mitzrayim because They had no choice or else they'd be beaten or killed. What does Moshe say at the beginning of Truma? Me'et kol ish asher yivenu libo. I am now introducing agency. As your heart moves you, so should you give. No problem, I feel like rocking out a little. Now look at the last page for a minute. Shmot Chaf and Dvarim Hei. Here's Dvarim again, the social radical text of the book of Dvarim. Shmot says, on Shabbat, even your slave must rest. Dvarim says something different. Dvarim says, Yom HaShvi'i Shabbat Adonai Elohecha. The seventh day is a Shabbat to the Lord your God. Lo ta'aseh kol milacha. Do not do any labor. Ata uvincha uvitecha avdecha v'matcha v'shorcha v'chamorcha v'chol b'avdecha v'gacha asher v'sharecha. And then comes this completely explosive statement. L'man yanuach avdecha v'matcha kamocha. It's not just that your slave doesn't have to work. The very reason I'm creating a Shabbos is that your slave shouldn't work. This whole legislation, yes, it's about covenant. Yes, it's about creation. It's also about leave them alone for a day. You were slaves. There was no dignity. Now you have slaves. They will have dignity. And your question now could be, of course, well, why is there permission of slaves in the first place? We can try to wrestle with that, right? But the point here, I think, is very dramatic. In other words, while Shmot is, yes, include the slaves. Where it says, no, this whole legislation is for slaves. And making Shabbos so that those who serve you can rest. And yes, we can discuss Pesach hotels at some point. Now, here's the thing I would like to end with, because this kind of blows my mind. Well, first of all, let me just actually say one other thing first. This is like a rabbi thing. I get two endings. So one ending is, whoever did the chapters in the Middle Ages kind of knew what was going on here, because in an interesting way, it turns out, I can explain my math later, there are 13 chapters of Shemot that are about serving Paro in Egypt, and then 13 chapters of Shemot that are about building the Mishkan. But here's the thing that's kind of amazing. What are B'nai Israel building in Egypt? Are miskino. No one knows what that really means. Garrison cities, maybe, or storage areas. Not really clear. And what are B'nai Israel building at the end? A mishkan. Except in ancient Israel, we know that people were not able to pronounce a shin. So the word is miskan. So B'nai Israel begin the book of Exodus by building a miskenot, building miskenah, miskan, meaning a garrison city with a samach, and they end in this totally transformed way by building a miskan with a sin, which is a dwelling place for God. By the way, that also is why that crazy Altipre that many of you may know works. Torah tzivah lanu Moshe morasha kihilat Yaakov, Altipre morasha ela meorasa. Okay, but try it now the old Palestinian way. Torah tzivahanu Moshe, or Moshe, morasa kilat Yaakov, al tikre morasa ila meorasa. That's a good al tikre. That's literally, in English, just adding an apostrophe, right? That's literally all you've done. Now, this, it seems to me, is sort of incredibly fascinating, because it is really about God saying, there is a different kind of society that I want here. And one of the key aspects, we talked about the vulnerable, we talked about the slaves, but now I want to talk about the dignity of labor. The dignity of labor. And by the way, the Mishkan is not ever called, or almost never called, Avodah, it is called Melacha. Melacha means labor that requires intelligence. From the word Malach, meaning messenger, someone with a purpose. I'm not just giving you busy work. I'm not just beating you so that you're busy. We're building something together. But we're building it with a commitment to the protection of your dignity and your self-respect, not to mention your physical well-being. Okay, thank you very much. Happy to take questions. I was gonna just disappear, you know? What was that, like a Fellini movie? Anyway, yeah.
I wonder how what we just learned comes into play with the way that God introduces himself to Moses at the burning bush as Ayah Shavayeh, and like what we make of the meaning of that name, or the cosmic meaning of Shmuel, or the national meaning of Shmuel, or whatever.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Like everyone else who has ever read the book of Exodus, I don't really know what Ayah Shavayeh means. I have to be honest and say that at least one meaning of Ayah Shavayeh seems to me to be something like, I will be with you forever as I am with you now. I'm not sure how cosmic that is, because for example, when Hashem says to Moshe, Ki Ayah Imach, because I will be with you, then Ayah Shavayeh seems to mean something like, I will be with you forever, right? As you said, as I am with you now. Like, don't be afraid. Both you and the people have me with you. That is a deeply historical as opposed to cosmic reading. The cosmic reading you can draw out of that if you want is that God takes that position with victims and slaves everywhere, although I think that's a little bit of a stretch of the pshat. There are many people, greater scholars than I, who still really think Ayah Shavayeh has some kind of like metaphysical, you know, the God who brings everything into being. You know, in context, I'm a little skeptical of that, but I defer to people who, you know, have more of a... I mean, William Foxwell Albright, I think it was, a great archaeologist, I think, who said, you know, that the original name was something like Ehaveh Asher Ahaveh, I will bring into being that which I will bring into being. I mean, okay. I'm not sure why we would make that emendation. And then the Shem HaMeforash becomes, he will bring into being. But why?
I mean, that is connected to the creation, that's why I think.
Yeah, I know, except I think that the rule should be you only make emendations when you absolutely need to, not when they further a reading that you are already committed to. You know, I mean, I just think that's not the way we honor a biblical text, right? I think, like, you know, in some instances, it becomes so obvious that, like, something needs to give in terms of how the text reads. This doesn't seem to me to be a case. This is something where I don't understand what it means no matter what you do to it. And maybe I'm supposed to struggle with that.
Thanks.
Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, please.
So, I'd be curious to get your thoughts on something that I've been struggling with, which is kind of in the Bereishit story. You have this idealized vision of God as the creator. There's, you could say that tohu va-bohu to order is in itself kind of a violent transformation. But you get from one day to the next, you're creating light, and you're creating grass, and you're creating trees, and you're creating fish and animals and the human being. And then it's only after the creation story that you start getting violence with Cain and Abel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But God is not an instrument of violence in the world.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Exodus story, he is. And coming off the reading of the Megillah where God is absent, but the Jews have kind of become this vengeful. We have the Shushan Purim. We have to go after that and go after the Persians,
right,
for a second day and hang 10 people on a tree. And where does all that fit in with the Haftim and the Ger?
Well, okay. So, first of all, I think it is striking, actually, that compared to a lot of the Psalms, for example, where God defeats the sea monster, Genesis 1 is a fairly non-combat-driven text. God creates the Tanin in that story, which is the ultimate domestication of the sea monster, right? Why does the text tell me that God creates the Taninim? Why not the, like, armadillos, right? I don't know why. Why? And it's because I think the text wants to draw attention to the fact that we are now, as it were, and this is Kfirah alert, we are now moving later in the unfolding of biblical creation stories, and they are becoming less cosmic battle. Now, you are right. What ends up happening is, and I think an important thing, God says, Pru urvu milu et ha'aretz, God wants the land to be filled with life, and instead, batimalei ha'aretz chamas, and the land gets filled with violence instead. What I think happens in the flood, by the way, for whatever it's worth, is God essentially saying, if you behave in a certain way, I will allow it to reach its logical conclusion. It is not, I think, to be read as, I'm going to punish you by going bananas, which is how, like, I was taught that story as, like, a second grader. I think it's something, like, literally, what are they doing? They're behaving in Hamas, there is lawlessness, and God says, okay, well, you know what? Remember how I pushed up the water and pushed down the water? I'm just going to get out of the way. Fine, you want, have it your way. I don't think that story is actually primarily intended to be about divine violence. I think that story is intended to be about reaping the rewards of human violence. Now, I don't mean
I'm,
that.
I'm just thinking more of like the 10th plague. Like I'm
looking at I'm getting there. So I'm getting, right.
Why kill all the firstborn?
So the book of Shemot, I think there is something there and it's very hard for us to relate to. Or maybe I should just say very hard for me to relate to. Not to like impugn everyone else here. But I think that there is a paradox and an irony in the book of Shemot. In order for the victory over Paro to be complete, Paro needs to be a strong enough enemy to be a worthy foe for God to defeat. If Paro can't stand up to God, it's no great shakes that God defeats him. And when God finally defeats him, God defeats him. Now the question about the Bechorot, which is a great question, obviously, that was actually a text that I skipped because I don't buy it, but I think it's interesting. There's a German Bible scholar who argues that, well, actually, you know, let me say what I do buy and then I'll say what I don't buy. What I do buy is, as much as it's a legitimate question, obviously, that you're raising and that probably we all on different levels struggle with, I don't think that it's Shemot's question. Because I think what Shemot is interested in, ultimately, is the defeat of Egypt, not the killing of Egyptians. And this German Bible scholar, just what I don't buy as the pshat, he says that the important pasuk here is Vayar Yisrael et Mitzrayim meital svatayam, and not et Mitzriim meitim al svatayam. The problem with that is that you also have like Vayavo Amalek. I'm just not sure that that really works in biblical Hebrew, but it's a beautiful midrash, if nothing else, because it's the defeat of Egypt. And so these people are, in certain ways, for the Genesis, for the Exodus author, not real. It's not, he's not worried about the Tselem Elohim of the Egyptian soldiers. He's interested in the defeat of what the Egyptian army represents. The larger point, I think, is right. The textual point, I think, is a little bit stretched. I will say also, this is just my own reading, I think it is really interesting that Isaiah 19 imagines that there will come a time when the Egyptians will be oppressed by their enemies. They will cry out to God, using the same words as Shemot, and God will redeem them and they will know God and they will worship God with Israel. And what I suspect is going on there is that Yeshayahu thinks that the Egyptians knowing God as having been defeated by God is something, but ultimately it can't be the last word. They have to know God as a salvational force, or the story's not really over. The Yidi'ah that is so animating for Shemot, let Paro know that I am God and not he, becomes, let the Egyptians know that I am God because I saved them from their oppressors. And then the ribbon gets tied, and the full redemption from Egypt becomes the redemption of Egypt as well. But can I really answer your question about like why did the firstborns die? No, I can't. I can't do it. Last question, please.
Can you comment on the following, Roshan? You said something in the beginning that like sparked my interest when you didn't answer something about creation ex nihilo. Can you comment on the divine providence that was manifested
in the Egypt story, Yad HaChazaka uVizroa Netuya, right, the manifestation of divine providence in the Egypt story, paralleling a very natural connection to creation ex nihilo, the greatest divine Yad HaChazaka was in the creation itself.
Well, okay, so if I understand your question correctly, I do think that one of the main reasons why the doctrine of creation ex nihilo eventually emerges, creation yesh me'ayin, right, something out of nothing, whatever that means, again, is out of a desire to raise God's omnipotence to an ultimate point. Without God, there would simply be nothing at all. But that, I just think that is a post-biblical thrust from a biblical preoccupation. Right? That is to say, the Bible is interested in other things, not just in God. God is obviously better than Pharaoh being on the side of life, but God is also more powerful than Pharaoh. Right? The logical, or you could say illogical, if you want, combination of that is the doctrine of creation ex nihilo. Everything that exists exists only by God. The danger is that raises God's omnipotence to the point of logical incoherence. Right? As a whole array of medieval Christian philosophers said, ex nihilo nihil fit. Out of nothing, nothing comes. Right? What do you mean, creation out of nothing? What I suspect some Jewish philosophers meant by that was simply that everything that exists exists on account of God, Metulo. And there was not this notion that you're making something out of nothing. Like, I don't even know what that could mean. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. What I'm trying to say is, I think that there is a continuity between Exodus and the creation ex nihilo idea, but it's not a biblical continuity, it's a post-biblical continuity. And it stems from a preoccupation with God's omnipotence. I personally would be inclined to a theology of God's restrained omnipotence rather than God's active omnipotence, but that's perhaps a different discussion for another time. Okay, I guess this would be my first time saying it, but Chag Kasher Sameach to all of you.